Hello and welcome to the Board Game Barbecue Podcast. This is episode 197. This is Dev, and I'm joined tonight by two wonderful people I haven't had the chance to talk to together for quite some time. Dare I say it's been months. How are you doing, Dan?
I'm doing really well, Dev. How are you?
I'm all right. And what about you, Sarah?
Hey, I'm good. Yeah, it's nice to talk to you both. I can't remember when we've been on an episode together.
I think it was since Dan's favorite game was Five Nimmt. I don't know.
Really?
Yeah, it's been a long time.
It's been a long time, yeah.
What's been going on? What have you guys been up to in the board game world?
I actually played some games today with my friend Kerry, which was really fun. And I've been playing a little bit with Zoltan as well. We renewed Love Letter. I actually posted it in the community. Yeah, it is really good because we always had fun with this one, just the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
He's very competitive with Love Letter as well.
Wow.
He's very enthused about beating me. Anyway, let's say that.
I think all kids are beating their parents.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's really good fun. It's a classic, can I say. I mean, you guys have both played it, right?
It plays really well at two. It's like, because Jen and I used to play it all the time, and some rounds could be over in like 10 seconds. It's like you get the guard, you have a guess. Yep, got it. Cool. That's one win to me. Off we go again.
Yes.
Another one, it does come down to the wire, and it's like, okay, who's got the highest card?
That's right. It very rarely gets through the deck, I think, with two players. But yeah, you can have some instant fails. You know, you get the minister. Yeah. In my edition, slightly different. There's a minister card where you get 5+, it's just immediate. You are out of the game. Whereas I think it's slightly different in the other level.
Because you had I saw your photo on Instagram. You had a fancy pants edition.
Fancy small publisher from Japan edition. Yeah.
Wow.
It's nice. It's just nice to have some different art. Yeah. Classic Japanese art sort of thing. So, yeah, it's slightly different with the minister, and I think maybe it's not as good because it's kind of disappointing if you are the first player, you draw a minister and a wizard or whatever, which is five, and then that's it, you're out, and that's like, okay, let's just shuffle again. And yeah. But so in
spend
a two-player.
More time shuffling than playing.
Playing, yeah. Exactly. And in a two-player, you discard one card, so there's always a little bit of something you don't know, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's cool. It's a good little game.
I like I haven't played it, but the cigar box version with the slightly larger cards, they have that. I think that edition has like a zero card in it as well.
Which is like the premium one?
Yeah, it's like an assassin or something.
Yeah, it's actually got two full sets of the same numbers as well. There's heaps more roles in it, and I've only played it on BGA, and it has been a while since I played it. I think I was going to invest in it, and it was like $60 almost or something, and I was like, for Love Letter, I don't know. But I kind of wish that I did. Yeah, it's not cheap, but I kind of wish that I did because the other roles are really interesting. Like you said, there's the assassin one. There's one where – because you can play with like up to eight people, I think it is. So you need to offer like – more win conditions. So there's one that's like I don't know if it's a jester or something similar, but you can, if you're a jester, you can say who you think will win. And then if they win, you also get a love letter token as well.
Huh.
So that way, you know, because if it was only one person each time with eight people to get one person four cubes is going to be tough. So yeah, it works that way. And more people. And I think the assassin one also works that way. You can assassinate someone, and if they are, I can't remember, you can get more cubes in it anyway and more tokens, however they look. I think they're little letters in that one deluxe edition. But
nice. That's similar to the recent Jabba's Palace version, which is probably my favorite iteration. There's one card that's the Han Solo card, which is a zero.
Yeah.
But if you have if you're left holding Han Solo at the end, you actually get a victory point as well.
Right. Yeah.
It's like you've lost the whole game with a zero in your hand. So the win condition might be whoever has the highest card wins.
Yes.
But if you're sitting there with Han Solo and a zero in your hand, you also win as well.
Also win. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't played all the editions. I've played the Lord of the Rings edition. I've played the Cthulhu one, which of course has the madness. You can go insane.
Oh, really?
That one. Yeah.
Cool.
And there's like insane cards and as well as the normal cards.
I haven't played Love Letter.
Like, you haven't played it, Dev?
Oh. No, I've been sitting here quiet.
Yeah.
<It's>, I'm excited. Explorers would love it.
Yeah, they would. I think they would. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Definitely. I might have to give it a go then. I revisited a favorite game of ours today with them, played Root, and I played with a new faction, the Underground Duchy, and Angie played a somewhat new faction to her, the Corvid Conspiracy, and mm-hmm. Penny wiped the floor with both of us playing the Vagabond. But it's quite interesting because I was thinking that, you know, there's some games that are worth playing with your kids because they create these sort of stories and memories, and it's not really so much about the games themselves. It almost doesn't matter if the game is, you know, Root or Love Letter, as long as it creates a meaningful interaction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the family, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
100%.
100%. And sometimes it's like there's games that I would play to use up that time and make it count for something, but sometimes they're quite a grind. And the game I'm thinking about here is Rival Restaurants, because of its simultaneous play. It's just too chaotic for me. It's just madness. And you know, aside from that, some of these games seem to be, you know, aging well, is what I wanted to say.
Mm. Yeah.
So I didn't think, you know, Root would be so quickly for the kids to pick up, especially with new factions, etc. But, you know, sometimes...
Do you remember how you got them into it initially? Did they see you and Dimmy playing it and were Root curious? Or did you go sit them down one day and say, hey, I want to show you guys a new game?
Yeah, that was pretty much it, because Dimmy doesn't like it. And
okay.
So I was just playing it solo, and at some point I thought, well, I might show the girls if they're interested. I'll teach it to them. And because of the theme, obviously, and the cute meeples and everything, they wanted to see more, and I showed it to them, and they caught it very quickly and playing it since. It's not a super regular thing, but it's regular enough to be very enjoyable, you know?
Yeah, nice. Yeah, Jack actually asked me just this weekend if we could play Stop Thief. Every now and then he comes into the office and has a look at the collection and, what's this one? What does that one do? And then the other day he said, can we play Stop Thief? But we just didn't have time this weekend. So I promised him we'll play it during the week because it was one of the first games that we used to play together with the app, but he's on school holiday. So there's plenty of time, as you say, to try and make those moments together.
Yeah, with Zoltan, it's just about like the interaction and being competitive against mom, and like it's not about the game at all.
Yeah.
And he's not interested really in the games. And so I've come to that conclusion finally. And so, you know, I need more games like Love Letter. I need more, like we also play Cockroach Poker, which again is just about playing the other mm-hmm. people at the table. It's not about the game really itself. It's so simple. Right, it's just about lying to people and bluffing, right?
And kids are so good at it too. You cannot tell if they're bluffing or not, because either way, they're just giggling and they just think it's hilarious that they.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm lying. Maybe I'm not lying. And yeah, it makes it.
Yeah,
makes
in
it
a that one fun. Because it's so easy to like double, triple, quadruple bluff kind of thing. Yeah, you don't know if they're laughing because you know they are lying or they're being truthful, and they know you that. You're going to think they're lying, you know? So yeah, there's exactly. This, like, this whole thing going on, yeah. It's a good one.
Brilliant. I was talking to Def during the week. I was telling him that I came into the office during the week, and as I said, Jack was on school holidays, and he was playing chess. He'd got my chess board out, and he's got an app on his phone because the grade ones at their school, they all have bloody iPads now, which is crazy. But anyway, he came home one day in the last week of term and said that one of his friends had taught him how to download an app. And Jen and I just went, oh, God, here we go. What is it? And it was a chess app. And it's sort of – it's broken down. They've completely gamified it in terms of leveling up and different sort of missions and objectives. And when you finish that one, you unlock the next one. And it might be something as simple as you've got the knight down one end of the board and you've got to try and land on a particular square, but only moving the way a knight would move. So it gradually teaches them all the different ways that the pieces could move. So what he had done was he had actually was playing against the AI in the app, but he'd set up the chessboard and he was playing it physically and then just following along with the app.
And how interesting that he wanted to get the physical components.
I know.
With it.
Yep, he wanted to. So he's replicating. He's doing it on the app, and the AI would move. So he would move the black piece, and then he would move because you can sort of hold on to. You can touch a white piece, and it tells you what your options are. And then you touch another one, and it tells you what your options are. So he's still choosing which piece to move, and he's just and so in the end, I just went, "Do you want to play? Do you want me to teach you, and we'll play for reals?" And he's like, "Oh yeah." So we put the Hyper Viper mat down on the kitchen table, and then put the chessboard out, and we had a proper game, and it was great. It was like, I don't know, it was like something on my fatherhood sort of check bucket list, sort of tick that off. Got to play chess with my son. It was fantastic. I smashed him, of course, but no, I'm kidding. I went easy on him, and in fact, he actually, in a moment of I wasn't concentrating. He actually took a couple of key pieces off me as well. So, which was, I was kind of proud because I left at one point. I don't know what I was doing. I think because we were watching TV as well. But I this is me making up excuses for why I lost my queen. But I left my queen vulnerable, and he pounced on it straight away. Like he knew, and it's like little things like that just went, oh, this is so cool. The app is obviously teaching him something. That's super, so there's a lot awesome to say for some of the apps and stuff that are out there these days for kids. I was like, really, really, because a lot of the stuff they do at school, even if they're reading and their maths and stuff, it's all gamified in apps.
Yeah, that's right.
The more
yeah.
books you read, the more points you get, then you level up. And so at school, they're checking out who's on what level, and there's another mathletics and things that they do, which is all just gamified, but at the same time they're learning. They don't realize that they're learning because they think they're just playing these silly little games and stuff. We didn't have that one.
I know. Zoltan's using a piano one at the moment. I was like, oh, I wish that I'd had
really?
This. Yeah, yeah, he's learning piano with I can't remember what the app's called now, but.
Yeah, Paddy's doing the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's just interesting how the gamification is coming, has sort of bleeding into education stuff. It's
yeah.
awesome.
Yeah. Well, the fact that he got the physical board pieces out, though, probably tells you that he's a board gamer.
Yes. I reckon he's got the tactile thing, because Zoltan would be like, it's on an app. I don't need the physical thing, right? So, yeah, that's cool. Yeah. I used to play chess with my dad when I was growing up.
Yeah, that's awesome. I got my grandfather to teach me when I was a kid. I was just telling Dan earlier this week about this, and because both my parents worked, so he's the one that raised me when I was little, and he taught me chess at a very young age. I don't know what sort of motivated him to do that, but and so I ended up playing with him, and later on when I knew the game well enough with my dad, and it's one of those things that stick with you, you know? Even specific moments, I remember, you know, I have images from my childhood around this, where I might be missing others that were potentially more significant events or whatever else, but I remember these. So, yeah, it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I didn't learn it till I was in high school. It was actually a friend that taught me, because my parents were never big into board games outside of like Rummy Cub and Canasta and stuff. They used to play with my grandparents, but certainly not board games or anything. So I learnt from a mate.
Well, going back to board games, I've played a couple of beloved now games in our in our team and in our community the last few days. One of them is I played Pipeline a couple of times with Harry and Connor, and I do think Connor mentioned that in the previous or a couple of episodes ago. Pipeline is just a fantastic game. I know Adrian thinks Barrage is better, but I also kind of think that he will reconsider that by the end of the year somehow. The other one is I played Underwater Cities with a lot of international people. Paul Grogonetti's birthday, and there was a couple of additional people, like a person from Malta and a person from the US. And we played Underwater Cities on Yukata, which by the way, is a really great implementation of the game.
Hmm.
So if you're looking to play Underwater Cities in a more automated, you know, scripted environment than Tabletop Simulator, Yukata is a good platform.
Yeah, it's equivalent to BGA, isn't it? It's got a lot of games on there too, right?
It does. The browser UI is, I would say, you know, it's not as good as Board Game Arena.
Yeah.
And in fact, in Underwater Cities, there is something very strange the game does. Do you know how all of these platforms sort of count live the points that you get during the game? And then obviously when the game finishes, they count the end game points. Well, in this one, it starts counting end game points that are certain during the game. And it tells you, oh, you've got, you know, Paul ended up the game with like 90 points before the end game score. And I said, that is the highest I have ever seen. I don't think that's even possible. And it wasn't, because the actual points that he had accumulated during the game were 46 instead of 91. But the game calculated all of these endgame points while we were playing it, which confused everybody. But other than that, it was really fun to revisit some games that I've played a lot and seem to, you know, be still fresh when you play them.
I feel like with Pipeline especially, there's a lot to discover, because all of those, like, those cards you can get, like the different texts, can do some really wacky things. Like, I don't know, is there something you go for each time, Dev, or do you try a different, because it just seems to me there's a lot of different things you can do, like
paths to victory. And I mean, especially with the expansion that jumbles up the entire board and action slots and oil locations, there's no two games will ever be the same. But even Underwater Cities is such a clever, you know, elegant engine builder. It's quite enjoyable. It's a long game, but I thought it was surprisingly fresh and exciting, even after having played it, you know, 30 times or so.
And you let Paul win?
And we let Paul win because it was his birthday. Of course.
Nice.
Well, I've been revisiting some revisited an old game. So last week I talked about Sobek Two Players, and Jen and I played that a few more times during the week as well, but also cracked out another old two-player game that we hadn't played for ages, and that's Jaipur. Which is such a classic, but it just got me thinking about these two-player games. And one of the things that and having played Sobek Two-Player and then Jaipur sort of on consecutive nights, one of the things I really like about two-player games that you can't really do with, well, what's much more difficult to do with more players, is keep an eye on what the other person is doing, particularly when you're, you know, sort of both going for the same thing, or there's strategy involved in what's in the marketplace and what you're making available for the next person. You really need to keep an eye on what the other person's doing. And there's no greater example of that than Jaipur with the marketplace, because obviously when you sell those goods to the marketplace, there's only limited rewards. And so you sort of got to get in early and sort of capitalize on the higher rewards and stuff. But having played quite a bit of sort of Res Arcana in the last month as well, which is, again, is with more players, I tend not to sort of keep an eye on what other people are doing. I really just focus on myself. But when you do play these head-to-head two-player games, you really got to keep an eye on what the other person's doing. And I really love that, because you're just constantly side-eyeing each other and going, they'll take something from the marketplace and you're like, yeah, righto, okay, all right, I think I know what you're doing there, you're cheeky.
And just waiting for them to take camels, like hoping they have to take camels before you so they can take the three camels, and then you go flip, flip, flip. Ooh, diamonds and gold.
Thank you very much.
That's all you want. Yeah. I like that constant battle as well.
It's a great to play a game. We still play it a lot. It's quick. It's funny. It's just a clever game.
Mm. Yeah, sort of completely forgotten about it. And then
it takes, what, 30 minutes to play?
Oh, yeah, if that, yeah.
Yeah.
I find the first game for us was a bit was longer, and then after that the rounds just get quicker and quicker because you know what you're doing and just kind of fly through it. And the implementation on BGA is really good too if you want to play against some randoms. And then continuing the tradition of card games, I've been playing, I busted out a few of my Button Shy games, specifically the Scott Arms games, some solo ones. Food Chain Island is a great, can I say it, Sarah? It's a great little game.
I've already said it tonight.
Yeah.
Why not?
And it's the thing that I love about these Button Shy games, and equally annoys me as well, is that they're so simple and yet so damn clever at the same time. I can't help playing them going, why didn't I think of this? This is so simple, yet it's brilliant.
You like have to design one then, Dan.
I've got a few things cooking in the background. But, I mean, Food Chain Island, you're just putting out these cards, which are animals, and there's a food chain. And so they're all numbered from zero through to, I think, 15 or 16. And the 16 can only eat the 15, 14, or 13. The 14 can only eat the 11. So you're slowly trying to get them, whittle them down until as fewer cards as possible by just moving them around and eating them by the food chain. But they also have actions on them. So they can't always eat the one that's adjacent to them. Sometimes they have to eat something that's two spaces away, or something that is that you can take two animals and swap them around. So it is super strategic, and it's just a really clever little solitaire game. And the other one of his that I busted out, I actually got it in the same Kickstarter, was the Ugly Griffin Inn, which is another kind of fun little one with you've got all these different characters. You sort of like your D&D sort of tropes that come to the Ugly Griffin Inn, and they all rock up at the bar, and then slowly you move them into the inn, and all the characters have irks and they have quirks. So some of them it's funny.
Irks and quirks.
So they have quirks of things that they like to do, and sometimes those quirks limit them from where they can be positioned at the bar, or whether they can even go into the inn into the bar at the first place. Or when they go into the inn, some of their quirks might be that they don't like loud noises. So if you have more than three people in the inn downstairs making noise, then they won't stay upstairs at the inn. They'll actually discard. So you're trying to manage all these people, all these characters as they come into the inn, whether they're at the bar ordering food and drink and being sort of noisy and revelry, or if they're going upstairs to sleep, and whether you can manage them because so-and-so won't sleep next to another sort of person, or they don't like the noises coming from downstairs, or that there's too much food so there's not enough drink. It's great. It's just really clever. It's nice little sort of hand management. You're picking cards going, can I play this one? Shall I play that one? And there's certain cards that are open so you can sort of plan ahead, but it's just really clever. And it's one of those things where, again, it's just 16 cards and it's like, man, what didn't I think of this?
I think a lot of people in customer service are not going to like that game. They're going to be like, oh my God, this is just like work. I don't want to do this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I know this person. This person comes into my hotel all the time.
They're going to do a revised edition. It'll be that Karen Cafe. Have you guys heard of this? Have you heard of the Karen Cafe?
I know who Karen is, but.
No, there's an actual Karen Cafe where you go to where the servers just abuse you from the moment you walk in. They literally point to a table and go, F and sit over there. And then your server comes along and just throws a menu at you. And yeah, it's this whole
sort of. There's a lot of places in Sydney that are like that.
Yeah, exactly. Even before Karen's was a thing, there was plenty of those places around. So yeah, I don't think I've played many board games this week. It's just all been about card games. I've just been really gravitating towards card games lately.
I have a two-player card game for you that I played today.
Yes, go on.
Have you played Hanamakoji?
I have.
Oh, how good is it?
It was actually Draven taught me.
Ah, yes, I know that he likes it. Yeah. I've seen him and Jess play it, and I was really keen to try it, and I tried it today, and yep, I can understand what the fuss is about.
It's really cool, isn't it?
It's very similar. It's kind of like Battleline, I think. Have you played that one?
I'm not familiar with it, but I can.
Yeah, I thought
understand the reference.
Yeah, that's finally a game from all of these I've heard today that I've played.
Yeah, so in Battleline, obviously, you're trying to win. I think in Battleline, you're trying to win three locations in a row
or five
altogether, right? Yeah, and you're doing like poker hands. In this, you're not doing poker hands. You want majority, so that's slightly different. And you want to get like three geishas that are on your side, I guess. So you want to win the favor of four geishas, or have a majority in points, because they have like total? A certain amount of points, a point total, yeah. And the amount of points they're worth is how many cards are in the deck with that geisha on it. So the geisha of 5 points, there's five cards in there and you've got to try and get the majority. So it's kind of a little bit harder to potentially get the higher point geishas. So so it's really interesting. It's basically just a round is these four actions. You have four action tiles to use in the round and you choose one. So you can do it in any order you want. So you choose one of these action things and the actions are you put out four cards, so two lots of two, and you get the opponent to choose. They choose one and then you get the other one and you put them face up in front of the geishas that they're relating to, right? So they're color-coded like the geishas. And then so there's that one, or you can do you can choose two cards to be out of that round. So then you've got this information the other player doesn't know. They don't know what two cards are out. Then you can put a card face down and that's one you will score at the end. So you'll just be like, ha-ha, surprise, I've got this. I've got the other five that you were looking for. And the other action is put down three cards and the opponent chooses one and you get the other two. But it's this, it's that battle line thing of excruciating decisions, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, what should I start? What should I like, which place should I just ruin because I don't have the right card yet and I can't do all the things? It's like that. You can't win all the things. And but the thing I like about this one, unlike battle line, which you just play out, you just draw a card and put one down, in this one there's rounds. So you might win the three geishas and you only need one more, but then you didn't win fourth one and now you've got to go again and you have to win those geishas and another one, right? And the other player might take the one of the geisha's favors away from you. So I really like that back and forth element to it.
I like to have the majority can slowly shift from your side of the table to my side of the table as
That's
well.
That's right. It can go back and forth.
It's a nice little sort of power struggle.
Yes. Yeah. But it really you need to take that information that you've – like those two cards that you've put aside, you really got to think about what you wanted to achieve with those, right? Like – I think I took out one of the geishas in the last round. I took out one of the geishas I'd had her favor. She was a two and I had both of her cards. So I'm like, well, I'm going to put that geisha out of the game entirely. Mm-hmm. Right. And then I ended up winning on the points. I got the 11 points I needed or whatever to win. So yeah, it's good. It's a really good two player game. I really enjoyed it.
I think it was earlier this year that Draven taught me, and I don't own it myself, so I haven't played it since, but it's one that I've been keeping an eye out for on the second hand market. It doesn't appear very often though. It's a thing, one of those games that are quite hard to get.
Well, that's a lot of lightweight, quick, small games.
Yeah.
Yeah, we almost did like a two person card game special.
Yeah,
yes.
Accidentally.
But I know you've played something else these days, Sarah, which is slightly heavier.
Yeah,
Let's wrap it up a notch.
My sizzle is I played the Alien Invasion expansion of On Mars today, and I played the co-op one called Blackout.
So you played Chapter 3.
Yes, Chapter 3. So I didn't want to start with the hard one. I started with the moderate one. We thought that we actually won, but it turns out we didn't because we made a boo-boo. So how it works is basically there's an alien saboteur on Mars and they're just, trying to sabotage all the buildings. And if you get I'll tell you how it works. So you play your turn and then you draw a card from this sabotage deck and it's basically got a building on it or an alien. If it's got a building on it, that's the kind of building you're going to put one sabotage token on. If it has an alien on it, nothing happens. He got interrupted or whatever, he couldn't sabotage a building. And then you shuffle the deck again and it rolls back to randomized again. If you get, let's say that in one turn the water building came out and then you shuffled it again because the alien came out and you get another water building, that second time you actually have to put one of your colonists on there. If you don't have any colonists available in someone's house, you fail. And that's what we got wrong at the end. We didn't realize. We just put it from the board. I think we took it off, somewhere. Which didn't feel right, actually. In hindsight, it didn't feel right at the time. So once you've got a guy working in there, he's basically working because there's a blackout and he's trying to fix it. But if you get five blackouts, that's it. It's game over. Mm-hmm. Or if you, like I said, if you can't put a colonist down.
It's, so it works like a timer almost.
Yeah, you've got to be quick. Yeah, it works like a timer. You've got to be quick. You've got to get, I think it's six missions. Yeah, six missions. So you have your personal missions just like in normal on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got three of those each, and then you've got the missions, the three missions on the board. So you have to do six of the nine, which we did. But then, yeah, like I said, we ran out of colonists, which is a shame because we had the tech to get loads of colonists, you know, the rocket tech that adds an extra person per rocket. And we did the rockets thing, but we did it just slightly too late. So, yes, it was tough.
Do you think it is worth it as an expansion that adds a variant to the game, or, you know, next time you play, you would prefer to play the base game?
Oh, that's a tough one because I do like it competitive, but I enjoyed it, and it was because I love the game. Yeah. Having a different challenge.
Yeah.
With that game was awesome. Like, yeah, I really liked it. I have no regrets. I mean, this is only the first scenario that I've played, and I would love to try the solo, which you were telling me, Def, that it's
yeah. Crazy, so I've played the solo scenario, and I've played the other cooperative scenario. And yeah, it was quite hard because you have like these locations that come up and they basically infect any colonists that are in that location. And that includes your shelters. So if you have people in your shelters and your player board, then one of them gets infected. Then if by the end of your turn there's other people on the same shelter, they get infected, the infection spreads. So you have to either send them out or move them around in your shelters to avoid that.
Yeah.
And then you have to build hospitals that generate medicine that stands them up, because when they're infected, they lie down. You can't take actions with them. And there's a new card that you can generate a vaccine.
Okay.
And then the vaccine is funny because it's this sort
of the token, a syringe token, long, right?
Yeah. Syringe token, which you place underneath the colonist to which you've given the vaccine. So he moves around with his vaccine so he doesn't get infected. It's really funny. I thought it was hard, but not as hard as the solo mode. The solo was, I thought, quite difficult. But as I said, I've only played it once or maybe twice now. But I got a few things wrong, including the fact that you only need to achieve four out of the five missions. I thought you need to achieve all five of them, and I was like, this is impossible. But yeah, I think it's a great addition. I do think that the biggest part of the expansion is the first mission, which is the one versus many with the alien invasion. So I really want to play that, and at some point I'm sure I'll get to do that.
Yeah, I'd like to try that as well. But yeah, it made it a unique challenge, and I have no regrets about getting it. I'm really happy that I got it.
Do you think that people that are, you know, intimidated by the complexity of the game would have a better, you know,
grasp
doing the co-op version? Because, you know,
I was about to ask the same thing. Because I own it, I picked it up during the Kickstarter, and but mine was purely, and I'll be the first to admit, it's a bandwagon purchase, because I'd never played.
Sick of hearing us banging on about it.
Bang on about it. So I picked up. So I used that Kickstarter for the expansion to pick up the original as well. But I haven't taken either. I've met a shrink before.
Wait, you haven't played on Mars, like as in on Mars?
No.
Oh, hey, time out. The podcast needs an interruption. Cancel the podcast.
I think Sarah and I were going to watch it we were going to play it one night, and then it just never happened. This was a long time ago.
That's my mission then.
So should I be playing the competitive, the original first before I venture into?
Look, I would say yes.
Yeah, that was my feeling as well.
Yeah, it's still added complexity. Like, even though, yes, you're doing it co-op, I still think it's added complexity, and I would definitely just do the base first, probably.
Yeah, but the issue is it's competitive, and so I jumped on thinking, oh, it's solo, great, because I don't have a gaming group that where I could actually get on Master Table, certainly not in a regular, in any sort of consistency where I can sort of, you know, be so familiar with it.
To be honest with you, Dan, I think the solo mode in the Alien Invasion expansion is extremely, extremely difficult, and it probably gives you a different feel of the base game than the base game, because it has this extremely tight timeline. You have to basically do 4 out of 5 missions within 15 rounds.
Sure.
And during those 15 rounds, every couple of rounds, the aliens sabotage and destroy things and take away your rover, or, you know, you can't do something. So it feels extremely limiting. There is a solo mode on Board Game Geek called Pathfinder, which I've printed out. It's only a couple of pages of instruction. It uses the same components as the core box. And you can totally play that. That's like playing against a human opponent. So if you want to play solo on Mars, then I'm more than happy to show you the game, and then you can go off and play that before you jump onto the expansion.
So
we can just play it after the podcast.
We've just worked out what our oath is.
Yes, show. That's it. What about you? What about you, Dan? What?
All right, I'm gonna bring it back down. Back down.
16 card game.
It is actually not a 16 card game. It is a 240 card game.
I'll allow it.
But I think you guys are gonna love this one. So this is a game that I first heard about a few years ago, and I ended up putting it in my phone. It's like, okay, must check this one out. And I stumbled across it in a game shop in Perth a couple of months back. And it's called Fabled Fruit.
Okay.
So it's really cute. It's got little sort of animals on it. And essentially what you're doing is you're playing these animals that collect fruit at various locations to make this fabled fruit juice. And so it's made up of a deck of cards, and the deck of cards are there's a deck of cards that have all the different fruit in it. So there's bananas and coconuts and blah, blah, blah. But there's also a deck of locations, and each location there is 4 of, and you start by putting out 6 locations. So you put out location 1, location 2, location 3, 4, 5, and 6. And each of those have 4 cards. So you always have 24 cards on the table in terms of locations. And then on your turn, all you're doing is you're taking one of your animals and placing it in a location. And each of the locations, each of the cards, have 2 main things on them. It has an action, and the action might be take 2 fruits from the deck. It might be give your opponent a banana, and they have to give you 2 fruits in return. It might be, so there's a lot of different exchanging of fruit and of collecting different cards, kind of like your normal set collection kind of rules. Discard 2 pineapples and take 5 cards from the fruit pile, from the deck. But there's also, each location also has a recipe at the bottom. And that recipe, if you fulfill those conditions, instead of doing the action, you can say, right, I've got this location has 3 pineapples and a wild of any fruit. And then you take that card, take that location, flip it over, and it's got a picture of the fabled fruit juice. And essentially the first person, well, when you play 2 players, the first person to collect 5 fruit juices wins. But when you take one of these locations, and there's now only 23 locations on the table, so you take another one from the deck and place it down. So that would be location 7. And location 7 has different rules and also different actions for a rule, and also a different recipe at the bottom. And eventually you may deplete one of those locations altogether, but you've substituted with another location from the pile. The deck of locations, there's 59 different locations. Wow. So there's 240 cards. You eventually sort of, you won't get through all of them because you're only playing 1st to 5 bottles. Okay. 1st to 5. The other rule is when it's your turn, if you go onto a location that someone else is at, you have to give them a fruit from your hand before you can do the action. So Jen and I were playing at two players. There wasn't a lot of that kind of interaction, but it plays up to five. So when you've only got potentially six or seven locations out there, there is going to be a lot of that. I really want to go there, but Sarah's there. Bugger it. I'm going to go there anyway. I'll give Sarah one of my cards and then I'll do the action. Because some of the actions on the locations are sweet. They're really, really good. And some of them, some of the recipes are difficult. But then you end up cycling through these things because here's the kicker. It's a legacy game. And what I mean by legacy game is at the end of the game, once someone has the first person to get five fruits, all the location cards that everyone has collected go in the box. And you start again with the deck as is. So when on your first game, you'll put out locations 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But in your second game, location 1 and 2 might be gone. So you're playing with location 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And so locations 7 and 8 are completely different. Locations 1 and 2 are history. And as the game, the more you play it, the more the game evolves. New locations pop up each time and it introduces completely new mechanics and things to the game as well. So at one point, a marketplace is introduced. Not that dissimilar to Zaipur, actually, where you can trade and things like that from the marketplace. I know that we haven't got to it yet, but there's another location later on that introduces a little monkey who steals things from the players as well. And so I've never played a game like this before where it actually evolves the more you play. And at any point, or if you decide you want to play with a new group of people, you can just get all those location cards from the box, put them back in the deck and just sort them and put number one at the top and start fresh.
Yeah, you're not destroying anything. So,
exactly, yeah. No, you're not, not like that at all. You're just basically not revisiting those locations anymore. But for new people, for people who are new to card games or board games or sort of set collection games, the way that mechanics slowly into the game introduces new mechanics and new things you can do, but a lot of it is just building on things that you're already doing. It's a really unique, really clever concept that I haven't seen before in a card game, which is essentially just a set collection. But the more you play it, the level of difficulty starts to ramp up, the decision space starts to change, the different things, and sometimes there'll be some locations that are really take-that-y. There's one where basically you go onto that location and whoever has the most cards in their hand must give you two cards. So you can target someone who is possibly going for a set of something and make them give you two cards, or you take three cards out of their hand at random, or you might give them three cards and they have to give you three back. There's all sorts of different things. And like I said, we've only scratched the surface. We've played about five or six times now. So we've worked through about probably the first 17 locations. And it's such an easy way to save the game as well, because it has a thing in that, I mean, you can always write down in a notepad what locations you have out, so that if you want to put the cards all back together and introduce it to a new group of people, you can always revisit the scenario where you left it when you played it with your first gaming group. But it's really, really clever. We've been really, really happy with it. And we're looking at.
Wonder what happens at the end if there's like
I can't imagine, because there are little components in the box that we haven't got to yet. And we accidentally because the cards are shrink wrapped, but they're shrink wrapped in three different piles, so you can sort of see the top card and the second pile and the third pile. The recipes get a lot more complex well in terms of what you need to collect to be able to. So yeah, the game does start off really small and then slowly sort of incrementally just ramps up in terms of what actions you can do and what recipes you need to get those fabled fruit juices. But at its heart, it's still a card game and it's still a set collection game, but it's just super fun.
All right. You've convinced me. I want to try this thing.
And it's by
Freeman Fries, the green hair guy. Fries.
Yeah, exactly.
Green hair guy.
Friday and
Friday was hard.
Power Grid,
yes.
And all those iterations. So yeah,
it's apparently there's a fabled fruit expansion.
The lime expansion.
Yeah.
But here's the thing: is it actually on the box? It actually trademarks this fable. I've got this thing in front of me. I can't find out where it is.
Yeah, he's done that system with other games, I'm pretty sure.
Has he? Because I have never heard of it before.
Yeah, he's done it with a couple of others.
It's like, this game has the Fable system, TM. And I'm like, TM? I've never heard of it before.
Yeah, he had a few card games. There's
nothing in the Fable range, unless he's implemented it in other in other games.
I think one was called Free or some. I know it's beginning with F.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think at one point Advent Games had all three of them. I think there were three different ones that had this similar system.
Yeah. But in terms of a simple sort of set collection card game that's also a legacy game, I was fascinated when I first heard about it.
Yeah. It seems like something kids could play as well.
Yeah. Exactly. And
I was going to ask about that.
It's easy to read. It says at the top of the card just quickly what that card does, but there's also the text at the bottom which explains it in a bit more detail. In fact, it also comes with a guide in the box which explains every single one of the 59 locations in a bit more detail about how they work. But again, the way any sort of legacy game sort of slowly introduces new concepts the more you play, it's perfect for kids or families to have a bit of fun. And like I said, it's only been Jen and I playing, but I can imagine with more players, if you're playing up to five people, it will get a lot more, there'll be a lot more interaction because if ultimately someone's going to be on the space that you want to be on, and so suddenly you have to sacrifice some cards to take advantage of that location. And yeah, a lot of fun. Highly recommend it.
Pretty expensive for a card game though, but it makes sense because there's the legacy stuff and there's like so many cards. I think it's like $70 or something.
Yeah, I think I might have grabbed it for $60, but it's 240 cards plus the other components.
And I think I was wrong about the name because Free Ride is Friedman Freese's latest train game. So I think I was getting confused with that. But I mean, all these games start with F.
A lot of them
do. Is there any real, can anyone blame me? Come on.
When you said fabled, I thought I might. This word means something to me, and then I remember there's this strange. This is completely different topic, but there's this strange comic book series called Fables, which is
awesome.
Oh, you know Fables,
it's Big Bad Wolf.
Yeah, which is all about these sort of children's fairy tales from decades ago, but they're like twisted and. In an adult sort of setting, universe. It's really cool. So that was Fabled Fruit.
Yeah.
Mm.
Got my purchase pen out for that one. It's out of stock though at Advent. That's a shame. It's probably for the best.
Well, I might talk about a game I played some time ago, but Dan, you mentioned that we haven't sizzled this game and it's probably a good opportunity to do that now. And that is 1960, The Making of the President, published by GMT Games. This game is about the 1960 election in the US. So one player plays Kennedy, the other player plays Nixon, and it's a tug of war to see who will win the election. It's a simulation of the sort of pre-election campaign, and it includes the election day where you find out who won by, tallying up the votes across all the states. And
can you claim that it was rigged and end the game?
You can flip the table. I'd say that's equivalent. If you've played Twilight Struggle, this is based on a very, very similar system, but it is a much simpler game than Twilight Struggle. So the way the game works is there's a deck of cards that gets shuffled and players draw cards and they go through these rounds where you go back and forth and you each play one card until you have run out or until you're left with one card in your hand. And when you play these cards, they have all of these historical events on them, and which is quite cool, by the way, because all of the sort of events that happened during the election are represented there. But they also have some numbers on them, and the most prominent one being the campaign point. So when you play the card, you can decide whether to activate the event or use the campaign points for a couple of different actions, the main one being increasing your support in a state or reducing the other candidate's support in that state. So the support in this game is represented by blue and red cubes, and only one of the two candidates can have support in a state. So if you're playing Kennedy that has blue cubes and you want to increase your chances in a state where Nixon has support, then when you're spending your campaign points, you're in fact removing cubes that Nixon has, support that Nixon has, before you can start adding your own.
Right, cool.
So on top of that, if one of the two candidates has at least four cubes in a state, it's said that that candidate is carrying the state, which then makes it increasingly more difficult for the other player to remove that support. You have to do what the game calls a check, and the check is simply digging your hand into this bag that's full of red and blue cubes and just pulling a cube out. If it's your color, then you've been successful. If it's not, then you haven't been able to do that. But the way you manipulate the contents of the bag is clever as well. Every card has a rest number, which represents how many cubes go to your rest area, and at the end of each round, they go into the bag. The game is very clever because it works over a number of rounds with this back and forth where you're trying to secure some states and fight in some sort of battleground states. But at the same time, there's some planning involved because at the end of each of your first five rounds, you have to put aside one card in your campaign strategy deck. So at the end of these five rounds, each player has five cards that they've been planning for. And then the debates happen, which is a separate round on its own, and you have like these three different topics that you have to play these cards and see who wins the debates. And yeah, it's very clever, and you have like, yeah, you know, defense and economy and civil rights, these three issues, and the issues have different importance depending on how the game until then has gone. And you go through this separate special round of the debates, and that gets the winner some, you know, some extra support. And then you continue for another two rounds of normal play until you get to the election day, where you do a few things and you tally up the numbers and whatever else. But there's some very clever things that players that have done Twilight Struggle will recognize. For instance, when you play a card for its campaign points to, say, increase your support, your candidate support in some states, the opposite player can trigger the event if it is favorable to them. Mm-hmm. By using, I think, something called the momentum marker, if I remember correctly. So, and because the deck is quite big, there's definitely going to be cards in your hand that have events that are very favorable to the other player, and you have to be very, very careful how to use them and when to use them,
yeah,
to have the less impact on you. At the same time, there's additional things like you can influence the media in the different regions of the country, and that has an impact on how they see you in the during the debate, but also during elections. If there's states that have not been, you know, selected by the candidates with for support cubes, then they get swayed by the media.
That's brilliant.
Right. One so side does the, or the other.
Does it? Is it simply whoever wins the most states, or does it employ that electoral college math where some states are worth more points than
it
others?
Does. So every state has this marker on it, and you can see how many electoral votes each state has.
Mm-hmm.
So you know in advance that, you know, California is more valuable than,
yeah,
you know, a small Midwest state. And so you have to be careful where you're going. At the same time, you have a little wooden token which represents your own candidate. And the candidate, you can move him around the board, and he campaigns himself. So thematically, wherever he is, your support grows easier.
Yes.
But at the same time, it means that it leaves some states more vulnerable to the opponent. So it's quite interesting the way it manages it. The rules are not complex. It's not a complex game, but it's a long game. So
how long?
For
two terms of 4 years?
Yeah, I mean, it probably took us more than 2.5 hours to play it the first time. Because the truth is, the first time you play this game, you don't really know what's in the card, so you don't know what to prepare for.
The cards would be a big part of it, right?
That's right. It's same like Twilight Struggle. If you play it for the first time, it's, you know, you have no idea what's in these cards. And so, but it is a very clever sort of back and forth, head to head game. If you like the theme and you like, you know, the political aspect of it and you enjoy the simulation of it, because the reality is it's meant to be a simulation, right? All of the events are historical, the things that happened during the campaign and actually impacted the results and all those sorts of things. I think it's quite clever. The way you tally up the votes at the end, they've thought of a clever system as well. So you can see printed on the states how many electoral votes they have, but instead of having you count everything, you put these very pretty round tokens on the states that show you the same thing. So when you actually finish the game, then all you have to do is grab all the tokens from the states that you've won, and the opponent does the same, and then you sort of tally up those instead of trying to count again and again. I think it's an interesting game to get into those types of political, you know, games if you think you will enjoy a strict one versus one type of tug of war game. I don't know about its replayability, because there's a big variety to how you can manage, obviously, the campaign of each candidate, but because the electoral votes don't change, you know which states are powerful and which states are kind of key parts to the election. I don't know how different the game will be after you play it a few times, but I guess that's no different than real life, because you know you know in every election, oh yep, these are the battleground states, you know well in advance where the result is going to be judged, and all those sorts of things.
And
so
I did say getting the cards at the right time and how you're going to use those is going to change it up quite a lot and be a new challenge every time.
So it's definitely a game that I'd recommend for people that want to get into these types of card-driven political games. And like I said, this is a perfect startup if you want to get into things like Twilight Struggle, which is a step up from this, but essentially using the exact same system of card play and events. So, yeah, it was pretty enjoyable. Want to play it a few more times to see how it fares up in terms of replayability, but I do think it's a game that most people that are into at least the theme would enjoy for sure.
I think it's fascinating. Yeah, I mean, good. Everything I know about US politics I learnt from 7 seasons of The West Wing, but even just the fact that they use, as you said, they use actual events from the time, and it's great. Do you think it would be easy to just refresh the cards and make it a Trump Biden sort of game? The mechanics are still there?
100%. And I mean, GMT has a history of using, you know, some systems to make games from different themes and different timelines. I've spoken about the coin game system in the past. This one, obviously, this game is a very simple one. That you've got Twilight Struggle, then you've got Imperial Struggle, which is a newer game in the same sort of using the same system. You have card-driven game in Labyrinth, which is the War on Terror. So you have the US or the Western world versus the terrorist organizations. It's one of these things where the theme is so strong, and if you have a connection to it, then the mechanics need to be just adequate. Not saying that this is the case here, but you know what I mean. The mechanics don't need to blow you out of the water. If they're elegantly you know, created and the game is well balanced and designed, then it makes for a very enjoyable game.
For sure.
Sounds well, there you go. I'd like to play that one.
Yeah, you've played Twilight Struggle, right?
Yeah, I have. I really
do. You like it?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. It. I did think that the theme comes through a lot stronger in Twilight Struggle than right. this game.
Yeah.
So
because you've got the space race, you've got the like nukes yeah, the threat.
Yeah. The whole Cold War sort of, you know.
The tension.
Squeeze, the tension, that's right, yeah. that's the word I was looking for, comes in very, very strongly in that yeah. game. This is still quite thematic. Well, there you go. Those are the sizzled games of the week. And, yeah, if you want to create some sizzled games of your own and you don't have the space for it, well, guess what? We've got space for everyone. We've got a couple of game days that are coming up in August in Brisbane and Melbourne. So if you are keen to meet with some of us and about 100-something people of our community that show yeah. up in these game days, go and have a look on our Eventbrite or website. We'll find the link and you can sign up to attend some of these game days. I think August 20th is Brisbane and August 27th is in Melbourne.
That's right.
And it's pretty neat because you can just come and learn a game and we'll teach you.
Yep. There'll be all the regular, all the scheduled teachers, which will be free to sign up for if you've already got a ticket. And they'll go on some couple of weeks before each of the game days. But we run plenty of ad hoc teachers. And that's the thing about our community. Our community is awesome. Plenty of people will bring their own games and then just go, hey, we're about to start this. Do you guys want to jump in on this? And there's always plenty of games for you to learn.
And if you're new to one of these game days, it's so much easier to just to come along knowing that you're going to be sitting in on something and, you know.
Yeah, that gets you started and then you can easily float around to other tables.
Yep.
Hey guys, Adrian here. And I'd like to talk to you guys about Advent Games, who directly support this podcast and our Sydney game days.
Hey, Adrian, are you talking about Advent Games?
I am.
How awesome are they?
They're great, mate.
Hey, wait.
I love the website.
Hey, Dan, are you talking about Advent Games?
We are talking about Advent Games.
I love how they have $10 shipping inside of Sydney and $15 flat rate shipping outside of Sydney, outside of the metro area.
Yeah, it makes it so much easier when you're checking out the website, all the different categories. Ah, the best. New releases, upcoming.
And Dean also has an incredible newsletter he sends out at the end of every week. So please make sure that you get on his mailing list.
Yeah. Sorry, Adrian, what do you mean? Interrupt as you were?
Yeah, I just wanted to say I also love Advent Games, and I have bought games for them at the Sydney Game Day myself and even flown them back in my luggage from Sydney to Brisbane. Dean's an awesome dude who is very community focused, and you'll even see him at game nights throughout Sydney area.
Mm-hmm. And he was one of the very first sponsors of the Board Game Barbecue podcast. So thanks very much for being a long standing and loyal sponsor of the show. We love you.
Thanks, Dean.
Thanks, Advent.
All right. Well, moving on to our bracket. Our bracket is sponsored by Game Toppers, and I don't want to talk about this. After this disaster of a result last week, I don't want to talk about the bracket. So skipping on and moving on to the
Oats.
Yeah. So the battle we are resolving is Brass Birmingham versus Root. Now, obviously, these are two very, very popular games.
Yeah.
And my mind went back to a comment Cole Werle did in one of his streams on ARCS when he was doing it a few weeks ago. And he said that when they released Root, they didn't quite realize how big of a success it was until they saw the stats on Board Game Geek, but not ranking or anything like that, but how many plays were being recorded by people.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Okay.
That's good. That's a nice way of recording it. People are actually playing the game that they bought. Mm.
Yeah.
Wow.
As opposed to just giving it a 10 rating before they've even played it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
What do you think about this battle?
Oh, man. This could be upset again for me, because like I'll kind of be sad if Brass doesn't win. But I mean, Root is a great game. I really enjoyed it. I played it again today, actually, and I played.
Yeah, me too.
Twinning. I played as the cats, and I've never played as the cats before, and I loved it. It was great.
Yeah, the cats are great fun.
It's so mean.
Dan, have you played both?
I've played neither.
What?
You've played neither.
Oh, my goodness.
Hey, I was already shamed last week for admitting that, so I can't be double shamed, okay?
I'm
okay.
writing a massive list of games enough. That you need to play right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, no kidding. I would have expected Brass to win only just for the virtue that it's still, what, number three on the number four on the BGG rankings, if you give that any merit. But no, no idea.
If Gaia was knocked out last week and then Brass gets knocked out this week, look, I am going to be upset because we need some heavy Euros still in the fight. That's what I'm going to say. Anyway, hit us with it.
I was quite upset last week, so you're not going to be upset this week again because Brass did.
Oh, thank God. Yes.
Move through.
Yes.
Not a huge margin, but decent enough to prove that most people preferred that over Root. But Root got quite a lot of votes, and as expected, as I said, I think both of these games are quite a following. And
I think we had about 200 people again vote this time, so thanks to everyone who
Thank you for everyone voting yeah. in. But what about today's bracket battle? We've got, so in one corner, we have the Shem Phillips festival of worker placement introduction / party of interaction that is Architects of the West Kingdom. And on the other side, the only box in my collection that is heavier than Perseverance, which is, of course, Anachrony.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So, can I guess that neither of you have played Anachrony?
I have played it.
You have?
I have played it.
I haven't.
Yeah. Okay.
When I do play it, I'll travel back in time and I'll my vote.
It'll be one game on here that you've played, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, so I played it. I played it with Kerry. She's a massive Mind Clash games fan and she's always trying to get me to play them. I'm not the biggest fan just because I don't know why, actually. It's like there's a barrier to entry there that for some reason is hard for me to pass, and I seem like that. It seems to be a bit strange because I can play up most stuff if I put my mind to it. So, but I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the fact that, you know, the world's going to explode, and you got to be prepared. I like the ending, I like the crescendo, the whole quick, got to get this stuff done,
get out.
Yeah.
What about you, Dan? Have you played Architects of the West Kingdom more than 100 times or less than 100
times? No, not more than 100. Far less than 100 times.
Are you in a position to defend it?
I enjoy it. It's one of my favorite worker placements.
Well, that qualifies.
Oh, there you go.
It's one of my favorite worker placements, probably behind Teo. Whenever you play a game, you're always looking for something that's unique and different. And to me, the thing that grabbed me about the Architects was that it wasn't so restrained into how many meeples you have. You have so many meeples. But then the fact that you can load up on a location and reap the benefits of that, but then, of course, you're drawing attention to yourself when you do it and you can capture other peoples. That's what I really, really love about the game, the interaction. I've only played it once with other people because previous to that it was all solo. But even the solo, it's quite solid. The solo play. So yeah, it's a really good for me. It was my introduction to Garfield games. I hadn't played any of the North series previously.
Yeah, it was mine as well.
Architects. It was mine as well.
Yeah,
there you go.
So maybe that's also why it ranks so highly for me, because I have a fondness for it. I do like Explorers and Raiders. I haven't played Paladins or Viscounts of the West Kingdom. But yeah, Architects of the West Kingdom, I can see why it's gotten as far as it has. And I got a feeling it's actually going to continue on its merry way as well. Only because of its accessibility.
I was going to ask you both about what you think is going to happen with this right after I do my sales pitch for Anachrony.
Have at it.
I mean, like you said, Architects is a great game, and maybe this is why I also rate it so highly, because it was the first Garfield game I played, and it's probably the game that I would play the most with other people in a group, even though Paladins is my favorite of their games. But Paladins more than two players is, you know, probably quite long. So, yeah, Architects is a great game. I rate it really high, but I do rate Anachrony higher. I think the whole experience, if you put it together, and that's where I think most people, for most people that don't enjoy the game as much, the game falls short. So if you play the base game, I remember even playing it the first time, I was like, I feel like there's something missing. The game is good, but there's something missing. Well, there's a whole expansion missing, which was added later in time. And with the Fractures of Time, the game is complete, and it's such an enjoyable worker placement game. The difference between, you know, building in your own sort of base with your workers and having to build outside on the surface where it's dangerous and you have to get them into their exosuits, but you have to charge them and there's specific slots. I think that's quite unique. I don't think there's a lot of games that do that as well as Anachrony does. And it does have a couple of twists with the time travel and, of course, the impact, which ramps up the tension towards the end, like you said, Sarah. So, yeah, my vote will go to Anachrony, but we'll see where our community members' vote goes. So if you are keen to help us decide which game should be on everybody's table, please. No.
Sorry.
Please vote.
Tickling my throat.
No.
Our social media over the next few days and help us decide who progresses further.
And the winner of this one will actually go up against Brass in the semi-final.
Oh, wow.
That's interesting because I think, to be honest, neither of these will match up with Brass. I think Brass is more popular than both of these games. But, hey, I've been wrong before in the bracket battle, so we'll see how it goes.
Anachrony versus Brass would be interesting, though.
As if that's going to happen.
Let's see. You never know.
I was waiting for you to say something.
I do think that Architects is going to win this, but I won't be upset if Anachrony does. All right. Well, moving on to our final segment of the episode, and that is our oaths. Before I do that, a massive thank you to our community on Discord, on Facebook, and everybody listening around the world. We've got quite a lot of international listeners, even though the bulk of our audience is still local in Australia. So massive shout out to everyone. If you want to help us out, you can support us on Patreon. We do exclusive podcast episodes there for our Patreon supporters. But there's other ways you can help us out. You can leave reviews on Apple Podcasts or a star rating on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. We have a lot of reviews there, and it helps the podcast get more exposure and more people to find us. There's still so many people, and Dan, we were just talking about this week, that there's so many people that still don't know the podcast in Australia. So if you have friends, colleagues, neighbors, go tell them about the podcast.
But you know who does know about the podcast? David and Margaret. 5 stars. A great listen. Always informative and fun. Really appreciate, too, you guys always chucking the timestamps and links on the podcast description. You're welcome. So that I can follow up on specific games if they sound good. Thanks, David and Margaret, for the 5-star review. And as promised, if you leave a 5-star review, I will read it out on the show.
That is awesome. Thank you, Dan.
I'm still waiting for someone to leave me a limerick or a haiku or, I don't know, some tongue twisters. Come on, throw a challenge at me.
Yeah, as long as it doesn't mention quokkas, we're fine.
Yeah. Let's put that behind us.
So massive thank you to our community. It's a very welcoming place, and it's always a pleasure dealing with you guys. So thank you. On to our oaths. So, Dan, do you want to start this?
He looks a bit nervous.
He does look a bit nervous.
Yeah, he does.
Not at all. Oh, not really? At all. Although
you're shifting around in your chair.
Although I was going to make my new oath this.
I thought you were just going to leave.
Oh, no. Yeah, because he was like shifting around. Well, you guys are just seeing my chair spinning
and just a bit of feedback from a microphone. No, my oath was Welcome to the Moon, which I did play, but I only played the first scenario. I started the campaign. I enjoyed it. When I first started playing it, I thought it was going to be a bit samey to the whole Welcome to.
Okay, but it quickly
starts to do some little sort of Hadrian three sister sort of combos and stuff, which I really like. But it was only the first board of an eight board campaign. And so I'd like to revisit it. And I was going to do that as my new oath, but apparently another oath has appeared in front of me and Def's giving me the evil eye. So my new oath, apparently Def, is going to be to learn on Mars.
So can our new oaths be to teach you on Mars? Are we allowed to do that?
Oh, you're both.
Let's do a group pact instead.
Double teamed.
Well, that's good.
Sure. But going back to Welcome to the Moon, I really enjoyed it. It's really clever. I found the rule book a little bit confusing. I felt like it jumped all over the place. It comes with all these little tuck boxes as well with things in them, but I couldn't really find any explanation as to what was in the tuck boxes. I pretty much just had to open them and go, "Okay, no, not this." Or maybe I've missed something. And I did a couple. I did a couple of playthroughs. I watched a couple of playthroughs online as well before I had a crack at it. I think I've just become lazy. I find reading rule books really difficult now.
So in that case, you're in luck because the On Mars rulebook is not exactly what you'd call light reading.
Okay. Good, because I need something to help me get to sleep. No, it was funny because when I mentioned earlier that Sarah was going to teach me, she actually said, we're going to play it next Monday. Watch the Paul Grogan
YouTube video before we play.
I think it's a good warm-up.
It's a good warm-up to watch it.
Yeah.
That's what I did. And when I played it for the first time, I also got taught by a friend of mine, Adrian Chu, who's a really great teacher, by the way. I'm always telling him he's the best teacher. Next to you, Dev.
Yeah.
And I won. Gives you the competitive edge.
That's a sign of a good teach then.
Yeah.
So my new oath, I, Dan Harris, swear that I am going to learn on Mars before I'm on the podcast next. By one or both of my fellow hosts here.
Yes.
Or by yourself if we let you down.
Maybe.
Because you have like to do it anyway. No, I'm committed now.
What about you, Sarah? Give us some trains. There hasn't been any train discussion in this episode, and you know I won't stand for it.
Yeah,
so.
That's true. I did. Oh, I mentioned a train at some point, didn't I? Oh, I did say a train game. I said Friedman Freese's train game. But you're right. There hasn't been enough. So I played Transcontinental. I did it.
Yes.
I haven't been on for ages, so if I hadn't played it, it would have been terrible. I had COVID. So while I had COVID, I learned a couple of games. So I played this. I played it two-handed solo to learn it, and then I played it with Kerry after I got out of ISO. And I really did enjoy the game I played with Kerry. I got quite behind in the game really early on, and so it was a real challenge to catch up. Adrian sizzled this game already, and he did a really good job of talking about it. So in a two-player, you want to get – like you want to develop these tiles and build a building on it so the other player can't do that as well, and then you have exclusive access to that location as a worker placement spot. So looking for the best ones and the most strategic ones – you want to get on those really quickly. Kerry beat me to one. I like wasted all these turns, and she planned it better, and she developed on this tile before me, and then I was like behind, and she had like two developments and I had none, and then I had like one. And because I didn't have the developments, she could get all these resources easily, stacks of resources. So I was so behind really early in the game, like from round two I was on the back foot. And so the whole challenge of the game was like trying to somehow get back in the game, you know? And it was really hard, but it was fun. It was a fun challenge. So do you think
the game is going to be better with more players? It's one of the games that kind of distributes the the gameplay and the
yeah
risks and the rewards if yes. more even. Okay.
Yeah, I think so. Because, like I said, you just cannot use the building if the other player has built it in this one. And there were a couple of times where I think you get 2 victory points if you help out instead. You just get 2 victory points.
Sure.
And it's just not enough to have wasted your resources to help out with it. You've helped them build it, the thing, and you've also not got a benefit at the end of it. So other than 2 right. points, and 2 points is not a lot. So, yeah. So, but I mean, that's not – it's not bad because it's so tough. But I think in with more players, like you said, you've got a little bit more semi-co-op stuff. You're helping each other, getting more developments. You can do a few more different things. Kind of felt a little bit – I was a little bit pigeonholed.
Sure. Okay.
You know? Like I had this one development that had like passengers and I was like, I'm doing this. This is what I'm doing now. I'm going to go this path kind of thing. Yeah,
I haven't played it yet, but looking forward to playing it at some point.
Yeah. Are you going to play it with Adrian?
Yeah, most definitely, right after we play the On Mars Alien Invasion. So,
and it's fun with next? The resources. It's interesting too because you're bidding with them to try and expand that line, and then you also want resources to develop. So, yeah, it was really good. It was a good game, and I look forward to exploring it more. And my next oath is teaching Dan on Mars. No, No, it's a cop-out. I'm not going to do that. I'm thinking of actually – learning Burn Cycle finally because it's been sitting there.
Yep.
And it just looks so nice. And
that's a heavy oath.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I'm going to do it. I'm committed now. I've said it.
Awesome.
I've said it on the podcast. I like it.
That's great. My oaths were a bit dodgy. The first one was to play, I had played the On Mars solo mission of the expansion. Now, my oaths was to play the 3 first scenarios. I've played the second one, like I said, but I still haven't played the 3rd and the first one, so that's still ongoing. The other one's a bit funny because I swore enough to play a game I didn't have yet because it was in the post and I thought I would have it by today. I got it with 2 weeks delay. I don't know why.
You're not the first to make that mistake. That's happened before. I'm sure Mitch has done that too.
I really didn't have this issue ever before, and this time it was just stuck in the local post office for 2 weeks, and I got it just on Friday, and that's Railways of the World with the...
Friday? So you've had 2 days?
Yes, it took me 2 days to open the box and sort it. I had no idea this game was going to be so big.
Yeah.
So that's still an oath. So I'm a bit reluctant to add something to it, but like I've put down on my notes here, I am going to teach Dan on Mars, so I'm going to steal that to see if we can actually make it happen.
Done.
So there you have it. Those are our oaths. If you do your oaths and you fulfill them, use the hashtags to let us know in the community on Facebook or on Discord. And that brings us to the end of our episode. One thing before we let you go, we've started doing regular streams of games on our YouTube channel. We're hoping we can really have this as a regular segment, exactly like the podcast. These are going to be every Tuesday evening on 7:30 p.m. on our YouTube channel. If you want to be notified, just go on the Board Game Barbecue YouTube channel and hit subscribe and get the notification bell clicked. And yes, we've done a couple of games, Bot Factory, Mini Express. We're doing another train game the day that this podcast will be released, called Isle of Trains, and a few other interesting and exciting things coming up. So looking forward to that.
Mini Express was fun.
Yes.
Who won?
I enjoyed that. Oh, someone. It was me.
Someone did. And with that, this is the end of the episode. Thank you very much for listening, and play your games more.
That's a good one.
Nice.
I like the replaying the games. Thank you very much.
Bye, everyone.
Cheers.
Bye, guys.
The deck is quite big.